This is East End Inc. Canio's Books in Sag Harbor celebrated its 40th anniversary in December of 2020 with an online gathering of writers and friends of the bookstore. Canio Pavone opened the store in 1980, and it soon became a hangout for writers and readers. Nelson Algren gave the first reading at the bookstore in 1981. Marathon readings of Moby Dick became an annual occurrence starting in 1985. Marianne Callendrill and Catherine Soka took over this bookstore in 1999. Along the way, they established the nonprofit Canio's Cultural Cafe. Here are some highlights of the December 2020 celebration. Unitarian Minister Kimberly Quinn Johnson read from Alice Walker's The Color Purple.
Dear Nettie, I don't write to God no more. I write to you. What happened to God? Asked Shug. Who that? I say. She look at me serious. Big a devil as you is, I say. You not worry about no God, surely. She say, wait a minute. Hold on just a minute here. Just because I don't harass it like some people us know, don't mean I ain't got no religion. What God do for me? I asked. She say, Seely, like she shocked. He gave you life, good health, and a good woman that love you to death. Yeah, I say. And he give me a lynch daddy, a crazy mama, a low-down dog of a step-pa, and a sister I probably won't ever see again. Anyhow, I say, the God I've been praying to and writing to is a man, and act just like all the other men's I know, trifling, forgetful, and low down. She say, Miss Seely, you better hush. God might hear you. Let him hear me, I say. If he ever listened to poor colored woman, the world would be a different place, I can tell you. She talk and talk, trying to budge me away from my blasphemy. But I blaspheme as much as I want to. Here's the thing, say Shug. The thing I believe. God is inside you and inside everybody else. You come into this world with God, but only them that search for it inside find it. And sometimes it just manifests itself, even if you're not looking or don't know what you're looking for. Trouble do it for most folk. I think sorrow. It? I asked. Yeah, it. God ain't a he or a she, but a it. But what do it look like? I asked. Don't look like nothing, she say. It ain't a picture show. It ain't something you can look at apart from anything else, including yourself. I believe God is everything, say Shug. Everything that is or ever was or ever will be. And when you can feel that and be happy to feel that, you found it. Shug, a beautiful thing. Let me tell you. She frown a little, look out across the yard, lean back in her chair like a big rose. She say, my first step away from the old white man was trees, the air, then birds, then other people. But one day, I was sitting quiet and feeling like a motherless child, which I was. It come to me, that feeling of being a part of everything, not separate at all. And I knew that if I cut a tree, my arm would bleed. Listen, she say, God love everything you love and a mess of stuff you don't. But more than anything, God love admiration. You saying God vain? I asked. Nah, she say, not vain, just wanting to share a good thing. I think it pisses God off if you walk by the color purple in a field somewhere and don't notice it. What it do when it pissed off? I asked. Oh, it makes something else. People think pleasing God is all God care about, but any fool living in this world can see it always trying to please us back. Yeah, I say. Yeah, she say. It always making little surprises and springing them on us when we least expect it. You mean they want to be loved, just like the Bible say? Yes, Celie, she say. Everything want to be loved. Us sing and dance, make faces, and give flower bouquets, trying to be loved.
Next, Scott Chasky read the poetry of Alan Plants.
For Rose Grobart. That night, when Denise read her poem about Pasternak's spirit coming to her after his death in the form of a butterfly found on the subway steps, a beetle, a winged bug, the only insect flying in the room, flew across the stage and lit upon her manuscript. She honored it by reading another poem. The next night, after dinner with her at the Ignatos, a bug flew into my eye. I went into the house for light, and Rose told me how, at Stephen Mooney's death, a hummingbird visited her only once. Rose, you too dwell close to what in me is, well, conceit. Nobody died, I thought, and no spirit spooked by human will caused my eye to grieve. It was the stars overhead beginning to shine, the wind backing to the north, telling me of the sea, the next dawn, the friends of poetry in a summer night, talking low in porch light, and one bug seeking the gleam in my eye for its uncommon joy.
Next, Megan Chasky read Valentine poem for Scott.
And I would say to you, it seems as if the night shed all its darkness into a softness I pull into, with your warmth and the certain pressure of your breathing body, like the fragrance of woods, understated, in the live curl of the scent of the world, in its moments of becoming, underneath every moment of turning. 30 years feels to the mind like some great northern lake, the shores invisible from one side to the other, but felt, always felt, from the center, in the dimness of light and the essential sweep of sensation, especially with my way of remembering events of years that bends them into images of color and sound and abandons facts on the lake border. 30 years, calendars, messages on the kitchen table of doing life as if we would ever get it done, of the congruent chores of mutual understanding that we've worked out as roommates of the soul chambers. And yet, 30 years is just waking up with you this morning and not rushing, feeling so sure that the tenderness is there, as much as the earth in her motion, and that we are each happy. Why should that simply not be all there is? The light of late morning, the fall of sheets around two body selves that know each other better than those selves within their own dimensions, through childbearing and grieving and waking up whole again, with children growing into their own body selves like wild horses. Time came like a whisper I didn't fully understand, with words too soft or melded for each for others to hear, the way they were meant to be. And so I hear then the way I wash them into my mind's bay and meld them into a new form of my own. Honestly, love, the music of your heartbeat has taken all bitterness from the edges of things, so that the center, even where I trained the yearlings of my young self in your arms, fighting against the long reins and kicking against the discipline, holds true, simply true. I know now it is where I learned what it takes to wring out trust. Not a trust given like rain, but pulled from the soil of misgivings, word fractures, too quick for truth, through the windy seasons of 30 years. I cherish streaks of sun and moments of clearing, rinsed pools, open pathways, and the leaves coming out seemingly from nowhere, until it seemed that where the thorn stem had been my study, it changed to a flower, and falling or ripening, caught my heart and caught my full attention, and raised a flood tide in my blood, like the sound of the mill of the sea, in the distance on clear days before a storm, carried through the woods, where I stop for a moment alone in intimacy with you, just by the thought of you. And now we come to the table together, with the flavor of sweet potato warm in our mouths at the end of the day. Our thoughts threading through each other's, while out of the choice word and word, we build a sentence that's as long as 30 years would give to any field of buckwheat in sunlight. One secret I may not have told you, just as you always know the time to plant here in this eastern seaside climate, by your own sense of something in the wind or the feel of the air behind your thought. I always know that you are really loving me when you kiss me and your mouth tastes like strawberries.
Next, poet and teacher Julie Sheehan read composition class for Marie Ponzo.
Composition class. Make it abstract, she'll say. Her students will tell her single motherhood is not abstract, is not a thought. Is it concrete? The smell of grit on spinach when tossing that crinkled pack of Ritz bits toward a snack box in a rush? Here's a thesis. Single mothers make the best poets, their senses thoroughly flush with failure. Single moms and William Blake do other than repeat the same dull round. Do other than repeat, put on your shoes. Do other than attend late and ill-fated recitals without their cameras, which abound in concrete fact elsewhere. Do other than lose. Read Ponzo, Wiley, Wollstonecraft, all the greats.
Next, author Mary Norris read Ithaca by Constantine Cavafy.
Ithaca. As you set out for Ithaca, hope the journey may be long, full of adventure, full of discovery, Laskagonians, Cyclops, angry Poseidon. Don't be afraid of them. You'll never find things like that on your way. As long as you keep your thoughts raised high, as long as a rare excitement stirs your spirit and your body, Laskagonians, Cyclops, Wild Poseidon, you won't encounter them unless you bring them along inside your soul, unless your soul sets them up in front of you. Hope the journey may be long. May there be many a summer morning when with what pleasure, what joy you enter harbors you're seeing for the first time. May you stop at Phoenician trading stations to buy fine things, mother of pearl and coral, amber and ebony, sensual perfume of every kind, as many sensual perfumes as you can. And may you visit many Egyptian cities to learn and go on learning from their scholars. Keep Ithaca always in your mind. Arriving there is what you're destined for. But don't hurry the journey at all. Better if it lasts for years, so you're old by the time you reach the island, wealthy with all you've gained on the way, not expecting Ithaca to make you rich. Ithaca gave you the marvelous journey. Without her, you wouldn't have set out. She has nothing left to give you. And if you find her poor, Ithaca won't have fooled you. Wise as you will have become, so full of experience, you'll have understood by then what these Ithacas mean.
This is East End Inc. We're listening to excerpts from the December 2020 celebration of Canio's book's 40th anniversary. Next, here is naturalist Carl Safina reading his New York Times essay, Melville's Whale.
Melville's Whale was a warning we failed to heed. In 1841, while aboard the whaler Acushnet, Herman Melville met William Chase among another ship's complement. William lent Melville a book by his father, Owen Chase, which was called Narrative of the Most Extraordinary and Distressing Shipwreck of the Whale Ship Essex. Melville had read Jeremiah Reynolds' violent account of a sperm whale that was white as wool, named for his haunt near Mocha Island off the coast of Chile, Mocha Dick. It's unknown what led Melville to tweak Mocha to Moby, but it's a good thing he did, and that Starbuck was the name he gave his first mate rather than his captain. Otherwise, the novel would follow a Starbuck's obsession with a Mocha. Owen Chase gave Melville his climax. As Essex's boats were harpooning female sperm whales, a huge male, around 85 feet, rushed and holed the 88-foot ship twice. No whale had ever sunk a ship. And Melville wrote, "The reading of this wondrous story upon the landless sea and so close to the very latitude of the shipwreck had a surprising effect on me." Melville initially planned a book about whales and whaling. Reynolds helped supply Melville with a more Stygian idea by exhorting his men to attack Mocha Dick, quote, as though he were Beelzebub himself, a demon rather than a whale. Yet Moby Dick is neither whale nor demon, but a white prop contrasting with the demonic Captain Ahab, the tormented tormentor, the malignant, abused abuser of authority and of men. Ahab's bias is personal and color-based. A white whale becomes a blank pincushion for Ahab's thrusting mania as Melville shades pages with his madness. Yet, and this was absolutely astonishing for its time, Moby Dick becomes the ultimate asserter of reason. In self-defense, the whale delivers justice and never dies. Ahab vowed to chase Moby Dick over all sides of Earth, but he can't do it alone. So he flatters his men into allegiance to his maniacal quest. "What say ye, men? I think ye do look brave." The harpooners shout, "Aye!" Ahab is impeccably skillful at manipulating people into abetting him, at making his self-destructive obsessions their own. Ahab isn't merely symptomatic. Through his ability to steer men into complicity and their inability to see it, he becomes contagious, truly dangerous. Moby Dick is called a great American novel. Perhaps it's the first great global novel. Melville broke through American myopia, vanishing over many horizons, rubbing shoulders with apostates, seeing civility in savages and savagery in the civilized, and ruinous obedience to mad tyrants. Melville's years on ships sowed what his biographer Newton Arvin called, quote, a settled hatred of external authority. By the 1940s, having ventured half a world away from America, Melville cast a frigate bird-like perspective on the American character's deepest congenital malignancy, then called negrophobia. In the early 19th century, sperm whale hunting was never far from slave trading. Thomas Beale's 1839 Natural History of the Sperm Whale, a book, included this telling dedication to the British ship owner Thomas Sturge. The dedication read, quote, "Your character may be estimated by the incessant efforts you have made to liberate the Negro from the condition of the slave. On docks and decks, humans of varied skin shades, breathing one another's sweat in close company, tended whale-boiling cauldrons and looked one another in the eye. Light-skinned men could feel trapped, and dark men could taste freedom, surviving, sometimes drowning, together." Melville's ever-philosophical narrator, Ishmael, asks, "Who ain't a slave? Tell me that." From a world he experienced as spherical from atop ship's masts, Melville perceived a sea-level humanity, embracing and celebrating the latitudes and longitudes of human variation that we now term diversity. When Ishmael finds himself compelled to share a blanket at the sold-out Spouter Inn, he declares, "No man prefers to sleep two in a bed." But he settles in, waiting for his mysterious South Seas roommate, who, he's been informed, is peddling a shrunken head on the streets of New Bedford. Queequeg's appearance terrifies Ishmael mute. But after things equilibrate, Ishmael reconsiders. For all his tattooings, he was, on the whole, a clean, comely-looking cannibal, a human being blessed as I am. Better sleep with a sober cannibal than a drunken Christian. In the morning, Ishmael wakes to find Queequeg's arm, quote, "thrown over me in the most loving and affectionate manner. You had almost thought I had been his wife." Now, there's no panic. Eventually, Queequeg rouses and by signs and sounds makes Ishmael understand that he'll dress and leave. Quote, "The truth is, these savages have an innate sense of delicacy," Ishmael editorializes. "It is marvelous how essentially polite they are. So much civility and consideration, while I was guilty of great rudeness." Reflecting on Queequeg's tatted visage, he concludes, "Savage though he was, and hideously marred about the face, at least to my taste, his countenance yet had something in it which was by no means disagreeable. You cannot hide the soul. Queequeg was George Washington, cannibalistically developed." Mates now for life, they find a ship, but Queequeg is barred. He's not Christian. Ishmael fast talks. Queequeg, like, quote, "all of us and every mother's son and soul of us, belongs to the great and everlasting first congregation of this whole worshiping world, in that we all join hands." Impressed by Ishmael's impromptu sermon, the recruiter allows their marks. They'll board the Pequod, a ship Melville has named, he reminds us, for a famed tribe of Massachusetts natives that he says were already extinct. Nearly two centuries ago, Melville showed us how easy it is to welcome as our own the touches of others, their equivalent colors, customs, and beliefs, their journeys, their transitions, and to remember those who, unwelcomed, suffered. How much could have been avoided and embraced had we heeded Melville's warnings? Melville feverishly scribbled a diagnosis, prognosis, and prescription for the human condition. We are all Ishmael, the ingenue, and Starbuck, the pragmatist, and Ahab, the maniac, stuck on a ship driven by winds we cannot predict, helmed by a mind not fully comprehensible, whose compulsions we don't control. The world is an elusive whale. We might choose coexistence or destruction, and though we do not decide the outcome, the hands on those oars are ours, and each stroke invites consequences. And lest we overlook the obvious, the men went equipped to do harm in their quest for oil. If we're all Ishmael and Starbuck and Ahab caught in our collective addiction, the whales exemplify a counterculture, a way of living weightlessly, of not draining the world that floats them. It's no coincidence that Leviathan, the sperm whale, is Melville's chosen vehicle. No other candidate qualifies. Ahab could have chased a fire-breathing dragon, but to face real quotidian madness, we must have at stake real blood and real will on both sides. Only this creature, the largest with teeth on the planet, comes to us as quickened flesh and immortal metaphor, tangling us with our own pursuits, profane, bleeding, sacred, free. Only Leviathan could do it, could win. So one wonders about those who've turned the book aside, as in college I did. How does one fare, having failed to be forewarned about our inner Ahabs or the risks of being led into complicity with madness, uncounseled on the wisdom of rejecting the obsessive quests that the world's pulpits condone and its ports reward? Moby Dick is only partly about madness. It's equally about banality. Herman Melville's haunting inquiry, whether Leviathan can long endure so wide a chase and so remorseless a havoc, returns to me again, while every whale in every ocean returns to share our air in seas we are warming and thickening with plastic. Melville wrote, If ever the world is again to be flooded like the Netherlands to kill off its rats, then the eternal whale will still survive and spout his froth defiance to the skies. But the warming that will erode the contours of Florida and New York, Houston, Hong Kong, and Bangladesh will make life difficult for whales too. They and all beings, as the naturalist Henry Beston wrote, are caught with ourselves in the net of life and time, fellow prisoners of the splendor and travail of the earth. Mesh by knotted mesh, it's a net we have woven perversely by unweaving the web of life. Melville tried to warn us.
This is East End Inc. We heard excerpts of the December 2020 celebration of Canio's book's 40th anniversary. Upcoming events produced by Canio's Cultural Cafe include the 2021 Moby Dick Marathon, to be held September 10th through 12th at locations throughout Sag Harbor. Sales are online in the calendar of events at canios.wordpress.com. East End Inc. is heard on the 4th and occasional 5th Wednesday at this time. Programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com, and the podcasts are at soundcloud.com. Simply search for East End Inc. East End Inc. is produced by Tony Ernst with the help of Marianne Callendrill and Catherine Soper.